Coming up on this week's book show, brilliant, heartbreaking, tender, and highly original, poet Ocean Vuong's debut novel, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, is a sweeping and shattering portrait of a family and a testament to the redemptive power of storytelling, written as a letter from a son to a mother who cannot read. Ocean Vuong on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont, and recorded before a live audience. Brilliant, heartbreaking, tender, and highly original, poet Ocean Vuong's debut novel, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, is a sweeping and shattering portrait of a family and a testament to the redemptive power of storytelling, written as a letter from a son to a mother who cannot read. Ocean is the author of the critically acclaimed poetry collection Night Sky with Exit Wounds, winner of the Whiting Award and the T.S. Eliot Prize. Again, his new novel is On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Ocean Vuong to this week's book show.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Joe. Glad to be here.
I can't remember a time of enjoying a novel in the beauty of the writing and of the sentences than in reading your book. This has been such an experience. And I'm curious as to the time. My understanding, it took about 4 years for you to write?
Yes, 4 years.
So in that time, did you always know the story you wanted to tell? There's the story, and then obviously there's the architecture of how you tell that story. So how did that unfold?
Oh, it's an act of discovery along the way. I think I always wanted to write a story about Hartford and about yellow Asian American immigrants working through Hartford, and also New England working class life. I didn't know that being from Connecticut has a connotation until I went to New York, and I would tell folks, I'm from Connecticut, and they say, oh, so fancy. And I said, how so? I said, oh, everybody there has sweaters around their, tied around their button-ups, and they go to private school. And although that exists, you know, I saw so much more than that. And I think one of the things literature can do is that it slows down time so that we can see more of a place. We can see more of a people's. And the great opportunity of a novel is that it becomes a geography in and of itself, a map of where we've been. It changes the spotlight of the national dialogue, and it shifts the spotlight towards perhaps a crevice that has not been seen thoroughly. And I think that's what I wanted to do.
Did you always, or did you know early on in the process that it would be in the form of a letter to Little Dog's mother who would be unable to read the letter?
Yeah. I love the epistolary form. I was influenced by Marilynne Robinson's Juliet, mm-hmm. which is a master class of the epistle form. And also by Moby Dick, Herman Melville. One of the lovely things about Moby Dick is that it's an absolutely uncompromising piece of literature. It privileges every vein of curiosity towards exhaustion. It's the antithesis of every workshop model of creative writing, which tells us to cut this out, cut that out, you know, make it concise. Everything has to be in service of a plot. And I think Melville was doing something, to me, quite queer, quite strange, in that he allowed a circumnavigating mode of thinking to be the praxis for self-knowledge. He was writing at a time where American literature was still very much subordinate to British literature. Hawthorne was the only established one. And I think he really wanted to cast dignity, respect, and interest amongst the New England milieu. You know, who are these folks who go out, this multiracial cast of characters, who goes out on this ship hunting whales to fuel and illuminate this you know, novel nation? I think in the same vein, it's an autobiographical novel. Herman lived that life. And having been inspired by that, I thought, what would happen if a queer Asian American writer also decided not to compromise? What would happen if he went on every detour, every parenthetical, philosophical, you know, inquiry? And the epistolary novel is the best way to do that for me, because the plot was the voice. The plot was the letter. And it's very forgiving of detours, because you can come back and you can just say, "Dear Ma, Ma," and that keeps the story present. And I think following Melville's inspiration, I wanted to cast New England working class life in Hartford and the life of tobacco farm workers as something worthy of dignity in literature to me.
In mentioning Melville, you write, this is when I fell in love with the novel, with this passage. In a previous draft of this letter, one I've since deleted, I told you how I came to be a writer, how I, the first in our family to go to college, squandered it on a degree in English, how I fled my shitty high school to spend my days in New York lost in library stacks, reading obscure texts by dead people, most of whom never dreamed a face like mine, floating over their sentences, and least of all, that those sentences would save me. That tells me that it was Melville not only that had an effect, an impact, and allowed you to write this, but also, as you were living it, to be at a point where you could write it, it was also saving you.
Yeah. And I think that's language does that. It's this absolute democratic medium that even if someone can write a text without you as a reader in mind, I doubt Melville imagined, or any of the folks within the New England milieu of Twain, Beecher Stowe, or Wallace Stevens, imagined that one day a Vietnamese refugee would read their books and be inspired. But that doesn't change the fact that those books were rich with discovery and the absolute ferocity of using the sentence as a means towards self-inquiry and self-knowledge. And I think I was able to see that, and I said, what a way to empower oneself, that reading actively is work, is as creative as writing itself. And I say this as a teacher, that you are most free when you're reading, because the text gives you one thing, but what you take away from it is the work that you do for yourself.
Ocean Vuong is our guest. The name of the new novel, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, it is published by Penguin Press. I have difficulty with the idea of labeling things directly, but I'm interested in how you perceive what you have done here, because with the narrator and that protagonist telling us this story, first of all, to be able to write that letter, that the drafts, the many drafts of that letter to his mother, that protagonist has gone through a lot of stuff and has lived a hell of a life. So there is great wisdom, there is incredible experience, but there's also an enormous amount of confidence, isn't there?
Yeah. The confidence is something you gain through being apprentice of the sentence, first and foremost. That the sentence can carry you. I mean, the sentence as a technology is a reductive one, right? The sentence narrows down as a structure, subordinate clause, independent clause, period. And it's almost paradoxical to use a reductive medium to expand on the world. And I think when you move through it, particularly as a poet first, I think that's what I mean when I think I garnered the confidence as a poet, because I'm looking at language at its most molecular level, which is the syllable, and to ask of the syllable, do more. And I think as a poet, you constantly confront that line break on the left margin. Mm. And it's a precarious task, because what it is essentially is a cliff. Every few words, it seems almost maniacal to practice an art where every handful of words you hit a cliff. But when you hit that cliff, you make the decision and you have to innovate yourself forward. And I think it was the perfect way to begin a writing career. And if I had it my way, I would recommend an earnest pursuit and engagement with poetry for every writer. If you could write poetry, you can write anything. That confrontation demands innovation. Every handful of words, you're asked to change and negotiate silence, because silence is architecture as well.
So in the architecture as a poet writing a novel, did you find a freedom or just a new set of architectural plans?
There was more tools, but it was challenging, because I wanted to write a novel because I started to get too good at getting out of the poem. Having practiced poetry for 10 years, I found myself slipping out, and the poem started to let me off the hook. As soon as it got too hot in the kitchen, I learned, not that I was good in the sense that it was successful, but I found the right turn of phrase to end the poem, and then I could go back to my life. And I did it too well. It was getting too easy. And I think as an artist, I wanted to challenge myself. And the novel is the perfect form to deny yourself an escape route, because the more you build it, the more you have to tend to these bodies. You have to tend to them the day after, a month after. You have to see how they heal, how they maneuver through the world, how they operate and enact their desires. I wanted them to have the pursuit of joy or the pursuit of happiness, which is the credo of this country, on their own terms, which is why I fell on a form that is a narrative form, a Japanese narrative form, Kisho Tenketsu, that does not rely on conflict as a way to move the story forward.
Is that a challenge? Because there are no villains in this story.
Right. It was hard to know I was doing anything right. But again, as a poet, that's a familiar territory.
Sure. Yeah.
You're kind of just floating in language, and disorientation was familiar to me. But it was a little bit challenging, because there was no model to say that this is okay. You know, I read like any good student, I read all the craft books, and they said, no plot, no conflict, no story, right? But I felt that it was fraudulent, in a sense, to have to create conflict within a milieu, within a country, that which is already conflicted. The conflict is already here as Americans. And I think it's not a coincidence that, you know, the two fields of inquiry, the two fields of art, of operation, one, warfare, the other, literature, have been dominated by men, both of which demand destruction and conquest as a way to measure their success. And so I think, for me, I wanted to write about American violence, but I did not want to enact or repeat American violence. And I wanted to find a different way. And I learned that when you surrender plot, when you let plot go, you gain people. A plot, I would argue, is the actual protagonist in a lot of Western literature. We have protagonists, but I think the real protagonist is the plot. It's the master of all the story, and all the characters are fed into the wood chipper. They're props for plot. And while that is one way of doing it, I wanted a way that preserve people on their own terms. The poor white folks that I was writing about in the Connecticut River Valley, I wanted them to have their own life. One way to think of this book then is that every character is a petal on a flower, that the book more lives as a flower rather than a linear trajectory, that if you don't have all the petals, it loses its identity as a rose. You need all of them sitting side by side in proximity, creating the perfect tension to create a story.
The novel is On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous. Ocean Vuong is the author. You're listening to The Book Show. Talking to you is just like the way I felt when I read the book, because it was just such beauty and art that comes, that washes over you. The violence. You write early in the novel, in this letter to Little Dog's mother, about the abuse, how she abused her son. And again, I want to get away from a label, but is a proper word acceptance? It is an acceptance of Little Dog in writing that is what happened, and there, it seems to be free of anger. It seems to be free of an impact and an effect of that pain, and yet, just by relating it, there is an understanding. Hopefully, that the mother would, if she were able to read this, would understand the power of that violence.
Yeah, that's a great, beautiful question. I think often we think of labels that you mentioned, you know, and one of those labels is victim. I'm a victim of XYZ abuse. I'm a victim of war. I'm a victim of various aggressions. And I think those things are true. We are factually victims of things. But whether we are living for the rest of our lives within victimhood is up to us. And I think that was the site where I felt inspired to write this book, was how do we relinquish victimhood and gain agency towards living a life worth living in spite of what happened to us. So it's a book about aftermaths. And I think one of the means that Little Dog enacts that understanding is through looking at the past, particularly in the sense of the coming-of-age novel. Often a coming-of-age novel is obsessed with the present, or it's either in immediate present tense, and then one comes of age when one leaves college, or one experiences sexual awakening, or what have you. We see that in Salinger's Catcher in the Rye and Sylvia Plath's two totems of the coming-of-age novel in America. But one thing that they left out to me was a prehistory. They're incredibly narrow in their range of the timeline of a historical American life. I wanted to expand on what a coming-of-age novel story could be, that one can also come of age, but also come of terms with one's history. And Little Dog understands his mother by inquiring about her history in Vietnam, which is also American history. And I think what really compelled me to do it was my suspicion and mistrust of forgiveness as a term, particularly how we use it in language. Forgiveness, I think, is much more complicated than how we wield it linguistically. And at times, it can even be weaponized or used to bully us into a certain state of being. Do you forgive me? Say it. Say yes, right? Or on the other side, please forgive me. Please forgive me. Yes, you forgive me? Good. Now we're done. And I never felt that it was that simple. I never felt that it was a threshold that was that clean, almost to the sense that I wasn't interested in that project. I was more interested in understanding. I think thorough understanding helps us arrive at compassion. That's much more messy. It takes longer work, but it's ultimately the more fruitful one, rather than just holding the enterprise of forgiveness over each other's heads. That instead of saying forgive or not forgive, we should say, how do I know you? in order to know each other, we have to know what we've done to each other.
You use the word prehistory. Is another word for that context?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And so then that amazes me that we have for so long read these coming-of-age novels without that context.
Right.
It was the context was almost implied then.
Right. Yeah. It's implied or it's assumed that one should know.
Assumed.
Right. The history is there. And I think a lot of it is, you know, for a writer of color, you know, the show don't tell doesn't always work. Right. And Viet Thanh Nguyen, our one of our recent Pulitzer winners, says you can do both. You know, you can show and tell. Why not? Mm-hmm. It's your chance. And I think, you know, a lot of times writers of color are attracted to the autobiographical novel as their first novel, because it's also a chance to say, I didn't arrive at the literary table in spite of where I've come from. I arrived here because of where I come from. I arrived here because of the people who nurtured me and the milieu who made me, one that you might not deem useful in the literary context, but one is absolutely informed by it. And I think Baldwin says when he wrote Go Tell It on the Mountain, this is the book that I had to write in order to write anything else after it. And I feel the same way.
Ocean Vuong is our guest. The name of the new novel, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, it is published by Penguin Press. You write in the novel, there's a portion of the story where a little dog gets a mood ring. Mm-hmm. And you write, it could be in writing you here, I am writing to everyone, for how can there be a private space if there is no safe space? If a boy's name can both shield him and turn him into an animal at once.
Yeah, that's ultimately the desire. The premise is that it's a letter to a mother who can't read. And it's almost a futile endeavor. One would say, well, why do it? And I think what excited me about that, when a listener is not promised, is the pressure now falls on language itself. Can language really do it? Does language matter? Which is the crisis of our country, the perennial crisis, ever since it was founded, before it was founded. Does language matter? Does my voice matter? Does my vote count? Right, these things are perennial crises. But I also think they are the crises of the private and the domestic as well. The great risk is to move through our lives and have the person next to us, mother, father, lover, son, sister, not know who we are, not know who we truly are, because we're too ashamed or too afraid, or language fails us, or rather we fail to meet its potential of opening and discovery. And I think, yes, it's a letter from a son to a mother, but it's a novel, which also means that this conversation is happening on a stage and readers are there. And so I think my ultimate goal is to write a letter to America.
Oh, God, isn't that hard to do?
It wasn't easy. Got a couple gray hairs from it, you know.
You write, in college, a professor once insisted during a digression from a lecture on Othello that to him, gay men are inherently narcissistic, and that overt narcissism might even be a sign of homosexuality in men who have not yet accepted their tendencies. When you write something like that, what do you hope to accomplish in the sense of, obviously, it shows a thought process that you've obviously had to deal with. But here again, there doesn't seem to be either the anger or the frustration that would perhaps come with such a thought.
I think I learned early on that anger is a powerful, powerful energy. It gets a lot of things done. We've seen it. We've seen it happen. We've seen a lot of wars. We've seen a lot of bills. We've seen a lot of policy come out of anger. We've seen the great cost of anger. I always felt, though, that that energy was not self-sustaining. It destroys the one who wields it, even as the world changes around it. And I always felt that thorough meditation and compassion was an energy that was more self-sustaining. It was more solar-powered to me, rather than the crude oil of anger. And I knew that it's very tantalizing. When you sit before a blank page, it's your time to talk uninterrupted. And it's incredibly tantalizing to write that book where you equalize all your wrongs. You prove all your enemies wrong, you know. And it's tantalizing. I was tantalized by it. But I felt that to carry that spirit into a book would ultimately destroy it. And why is that? I always felt that a book at its best is a town square. You build an architecture that contains people who are transitory, people who might live nearby, but you build a book that's a town square so people can come, meet each other, meet these characters, and have a discussion on their own terms. As a reader, I feel more powerful when a text is offered to me as a landscape in which I can enact my imagination and my thinking within it, rather than being beaten by the cudgel of, you know, didacticism. And I think it's a fine line to write difficult subjects without anger. But I think it was my Buddhism practice that helped me. I meditate every day. And I wanted to write a book that was rich with American life, informed with American music and culture, from 50 Cent to Ralph Stanley, but also to live and think within the bones of Asian philosophy. Kisho Tenketsu has a narrative form that Hayao Miyazaki uses in his films, and Zen Buddhism as a way to look at the world. And I wanted all of it. I wanted all of those cultures to stand side by side, inform each other, and strengthen one another.
I found it fascinating in reading that there was a timelessness to the story. Of course, the Vietnam War very much a part, but there is a timelessness. And every once in a while, you address things that are current, let's say, and it can be a little jarring. You write a lot about Tiger Woods.
Mm. I always knew and was drawn to Woods and how, you know, the American media carries such a character. In this country, we're obsessed with our heroes. We mythologize our sports heroes and our movie stars and our pop stars, but we don't allow them a thorough history. We don't want them to have a history. We want them to be the phenom. We're obsessed with the phenom. You know, Woods is celebrated when he does well, when he does poorly, both on and off the golf course. You know, we brush him aside, and we're a country that's a little uneasy with failure, right? Get off the stage. Don't tell us the losing record. Don't tell us if you lose your job. You know, keep those things away. And Woods was incredibly potent for me as a mixed-race Asian-American man who doesn't get that part of his history examined in the limelight.
Ocean Vuong is the author of the debut novel, On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous. It is published by Penguin Press. Ocean, what a great pleasure and honor to speak to you.
Absolute honor, Joe. Thank you so, so much.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded in Manchester Center, Vermont, in partnership with Northshire Bookstore, northshire.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.